There we go. Excellent. Excellent, excellent. So welcome everybody. This is class number three, the C sequence in the pelvis, hip, and sacrum principles course. The theme today is hip drop. We did hip shift. Now we're doing hip drop. And the last two lectures had a lot of information, and we kind of plowed through it to make sure you had enough context to go out there and either play with the ideas on your own or check out the videos if you're doing that version of the course. And now we get to slow it down a little bit and start to even focus even more on bringing it into our own bodies. I'm thinking before I do this thing though, we're gonna do our usual avoiding the multitasking. Yeah, I take this off the screen for a second. So if you can just let anything go that you don't need, you know, don't need to be doing right now, you can just do this. So avoiding the multitasking. Yeah, engaging your mind. So you got something there to take notes with, or you got some questions in mind, you're gonna look for them. Look for the things that make you interested or make you curious as we go. Yeah, and then engage your body. Last but certainly not least, engage your body. You can start with a big breath, yeah? But because breathing as we go actually helps you integrate your experience. It probably helps the information sink in too. But we're gonna keep our kinesthetic channels open. And I asked Chris if he would actually start us out today with some movement around our theme, which is hip drop. You ready to take it, Chris? I'm going to spotlight you if so.
All right. I think I'm unmuted. Can you hear me okay, Joe?
Yes, that's a yes. You're loud and clear.
And I'm not seeing an image of me. Do you have what do you have set up for screen? Oh, there we go. All right. Am I on?
You're on.
All right. Can I get some thumbs up everyone can see me okay? All right, good enough. So if you're at home, find a bench or your couch or a stool. And let's start with just using our right leg. If you place your right heel on the couch or on the stool, find that and find a place where you're comfortable and balanced. And the height issue is, I always recommend something around knee height or lower is probably the easiest. The idea of this is that you're not overly challenging your hamstrings, so you can actually relax your hip. And so with your right heel on the surface, allow yourself to feel the weight of your right foot. So become heavy in your heel, become heavy in the back of your knee. And then see if you can allow your right hip to also become heavy. It's like you're allowing it to rest towards the floor. And the question is, are you allowing your hip to drop as you lift your foot? So our leg is resting in gravity. And to find out if you've actually allowed your hip to drop, try hiking your hip. See what happens if you lift your right hip up a little bit and then allow it to drop again. And just practice that a couple times and see if you can sense when you've really released your hip and allowed it to rest towards the floor. And you'll notice when you allow your right hip to drop, you'll also have a little bit of a hip shift in your left hip. So you can kind of see how these two movements are related. But our focus today really is allowing the hip to drop. So if this is comfortable, gently challenge yourself just a little bit. And a very simple way would be to go into forward flexion at your hip joint just slightly. So if I lean forward a little bit, I start to feel my hamstrings pretty quickly. I don't have particularly loose hamstrings. And I want to find a place where I have just a little resistance.
So and Chris, then, can I throw in a question there?
Absolutely.
So I got my heel on the thing. I'm letting my hip drop, my right hip drop in your case. And I keep it dropped as I start to flex forward at the hip.
Yeah. So as you flex forward, you're challenging yourself slightly. can you now release your hip again? Notice if you've actually hiked it. So give yourself a moment to be slightly flexed and allow your hip to drop. And just find a place where that feels comfortable and safe. And then as a movement exercise to see if you can maintain a dropped hip, simply come out of your flexion slightly, back to neutral. Find your heavy heel, your heavy hip, and then come back into hip flexion just slightly and recheck in. Ask yourself, can you allow your hip to drop? So this is a really simple exercise to practice hip drop. It's very easy to do with our clients. You can actually be supporting their heel in your hand and talking them through this exercise. And you get to feel if they're resting their leg and discuss that with them. So other variations of this, now that you've found this one, it's very simple, but once you've found this, play with another variation. So for example, if you take your left foot, which is on the ground, and just walk it out slightly. So turn your foot out a little bit.
So I still got the first leg up. I still got my right heel on the bench, huh?
Yeah, same.
Still first leg. Right.
And so you've simply changed relationship in terms of adduction, abduction. You've basically taken the right leg and it's now opened more because you've turned your left foot out slightly. So just a small variation. And then come back to the sensation of allowing your hip to rest, your heel to be heavy, your leg to be heavy. And then play with just simply flexing very slightly, gentle challenge. And in that flex position, allow your hip to drop again. And then slowly come back up a little bit, maybe move back and forth a little bit, seeing if you can maintain hip drop in the right hip as you move. And then once you've mastered that, let's take the left foot, the one on the ground, and we'll turn it in this time. But you'll be turning towards the leg that's on the bench. You're turning towards your right leg. Find a comfortable position where you're balanced. And then come back to the sensation of dropping your right hip. Once you're comfortable, flex very slightly at the hip.
No rush, by the way, no rush. That's really the key, what he's saying, is taking time to really get that drop feeling in the hip. We've been on that one leg for a while now, so it's starting to work, but just taking time to really settle into the drop is the point of what Chris is doing with us.
Yeah. And oftentimes, if we're challenging ourselves just a little bit, we tend to forget. So come back to checking in with your hip drop. And then you can move back and forth, flexion, back to neutral. Playing with leaving your hip heavy, your heel heavy. And then to come out of this, just as a way of helping yourself and your clients to really kind of drive home the idea of allowing your hip to rest, find a way to come off of the stool or off of the couch without hiking your hip. So you may have to fall back just a little bit, but see if you can really rest your heel and rest your hip until you can take your foot off of the surface, really resting, and then dropping your foot to the floor. And then take a moment, just maybe 4 or 5 steps, walk around the room, check in and see what you feel now that you've experienced that. Notice what it feels like to pick up your right leg versus your left leg in your walk. And notice anything new around your awarenesses in your hip or your back. Notice what's the first thing that comes to your mind that you're aware of that's a new experience for you that differs from the other leg we haven't done it with. And I imagine most of you will feel a little different. And of course, we have the opportunity to do the other side too. Till, do we have time to walk through that?
Totally, let's do it.
All right, let's switch sides. We're now taking our left foot up onto the surface. Find a place where you're comfortable. And then walk yourself through that sequence of check-ins. So you're allowing your heel to get heavy. You're allowing the back of your leg to get heavy. And then you're allowing your hip to rest. And sometimes even having your hand on your hip will help you send a message of allowing it to drop towards the floor. And if you're not sure, practice hiking your hips slightly. So come up and then drop again to feel what it's like to rest. And notice as you hike and then drop your hip, you'll also be shifting into your right hip at the same time. So you get to feel both actions happening together. Once you're comfortable with your drop tip, gently.
Take your time with that. Take your time with that too. And I'm, Chris, I'm interrupting a little bit because I'm looking around the room. It's kind of cool to see what people are doing. Like Aranda, you're like challenging yourself with a big ball there. I know you're super flexible, but at some point, the higher you go there, the harder it is to drop. So the point is not to go really high and give yourself a big hamstring stretch, but to find the height that allows you to drop that hip. Yeah, Jason, perfect angle there. Very nice.
They avoid over-challenging yourself. Again, it's not really so much a stretch as a reminding your nervous system, you know, are you relaxing your hip when you walk? Are you hanging your hip? This is a very perceptual exercise. So I'm doing a little flexion and then coming back to neutral. And I'm just checking in. Can I move back and forth and leave my hip heavy?
Leaving the hip heavy, but then with the rest of your body almost pretending to be undisturbed so that it's like in a neutral standing position, except when you're doing the hip forward flexion. So you're playing with hip drop, with the rest of your body in a neutral anatomical position, say, except when you're playing with the hip flexion.
A nice reminder is that our arms are still part of how we walk around. Even though we're not on all fours, we still use the arms as counterweights. And there, we're orienting ourselves with our arms too. So if you allow your arms to really dangle and your hands to be soft while you're playing with this, that's all part of the experience too.
Yeah, Jeremiah looking good there. Like the beard, by the way.
So playing with other variations, if you're ready, we can turn the right foot out this time. You'll start to turn away from the leg that's on the surface on the couch. And then recheck in with your hip drop. And then small flexion movements. Checking in all the time. And then playing with another position, you can take your right foot, turn in towards your left leg.
Roberta, if you have the option, something lower might make that easier too to drop. It doesn't have to be real high.
Another piece to consider is the support of the standing leg. So the foot that's on the floor, really allow yourself to be heavy in that too. You might even explore really sensing the surface you're standing on, because that's also feeding how you hold your other leg. So the more soft and more weighted you feel in your body, internally, externally, that's all part of, again, organizing your body in space and developing a foundation of feeling supported. So you're feeding your brain with information.
Looking great, Doris. Yep, looking great. It's nice to have a wall sometimes to balance with. And you can let your head float too, like Audrey, or it's like if you just imagine an upward floating as well as letting your hip drop, that'll give you that two-dimensional sense.
You can imagine being heavy in your legs, but listening to the space around you simultaneously. That gives you kind of a sense of two directions around which your body can kind of loosen and lengthen. How are we doing, Jill?
Looking great there. This is so cool. I wish I could just show you what everyone's doing. There's so many cool variations people are doing.
So this is one of those exercises where there's lots of room for being playful. You get to explore all sorts of edges in your body. And then if everyone's in a good place, let's play with releasing a leg. This is also a key part of the exercise. How do you let go of the surface you raise your leg onto without efforting? So as you come off of the couch or off of the stool, think of allowing your hip to remain heavy. Take your time. I'm essentially leaning back just slightly to drag my heel off the couch and really allowing my hip to remain heavy through the process. And I'll see if I can just drop my leg down to the floor again. And then take a moment, have a stroll around your room, check in, see how you feel.
If you're already back in your chair, then you can just check in a seated place too. It's like starting with the body. It takes a certain amount of intentionality to keep the body involved in this process. And it's good. And we can find a way to do that. It's good. I mean, we're all getting practice with Zoom here. And, you know, one of them really is the body. Okay. I'm going to take you through the lecture for the C sequence. If you got questions, let me check in with our chat hosts. Any comments, chat hosts, that we should say something about before we go forward? If you got questions, by the way, you can chat them into the chat. Go ahead, Nikki.
Yep, just a lot of feels good, more balanced, more grounded. I would imagine your experience is greatly influenced by your pelvic tilt. Hips feel more open. Just a lot of positive sensational feelings, feeling more differentiation front to back, more relaxed.
Cool. Great. No, it's true.
Here's one question, Till. Mm-hmm. I assume having hip dropping is better than hip hiking.
Well, that's a good question. Is chocolate better than vanilla? That's a question. Yeah, Larry says yes, chocolate's better than vanilla. But we want the capacity for both, let's say. We want the options for movement. We're inclusive in our biases toward movement here, that we want to be able to drop it when you need to. And yeah, you definitely want to be able to hike it if you need that as well. The problems come when you lose one or the other. You don't have as much capacity for one or the other. So the point of what Chris was doing was to let you practice with dropping, to feel how that the dropping is available or not available in a few different motions, but it's not like that's the only way to go. I will say that in your practice, if it's anything like mine, most of the people you see will have more challenges letting it drop than hiking it. There is the opposite, but most of us can get better at letting it drop, perhaps.
I do have a few more here, Till.
Sure, go for it.
One from Juliet. Client will be describing sensations the entire time.
Yeah. If I'm doing this with a client, it's often like what Chris was doing. I'm guiding them through. I'm guiding their awareness toward the drop. I keep coming back to the drop. We might play with little variations. I'm watching them on, this can be done against a wall. If you've done it in a classroom, you typically do it against the wall. So you've got that support behind you for balance. And I'll be checking in about sensation. But more than that, I'll be guiding them. It's more of a guided intervention typically where I'm helping them get clear on the ability to drop. And almost without exception, you get multiple layers of drop. You get like the initial like, oh, drop your hip. And most people can go like that. But then if you hang out and you take a breath and you settle a little bit, you find, oh, there's even more there. And occasionally it's the opposite. Occasionally you say, drop your hip, and people have no idea what you mean. So in that case, it's actually helpful to hike the hip up and contrast that with letting it drop intentionally, like Chris had us do a couple of times in that as well.
We have one from Brian. Can this be used for sacroiliac ligaments?
As much as anything else, yeah. I'll go through the anatomy and you'll see how what specific inanimate might relate to. That isn't the first place I would necessarily think, but it's a global movement patterning exercise where we're really getting to know what drop is like. And then the capacity for drop keeps those ligaments happy and keeps lots of things happy.
I have a couple questions on knees.
Couple more and then I'm going to move on, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, there's two on asking people about knees. Someone felt pressure in the back of the knee and should knees be soft, felt pain when knees were locked.
Yeah. You know the old story about the guy went to the doctor and says, it hurts when I do this. The doctor says, don't do that. So none of this should cause you more pain than you want. And if hyperextending your knees is painful, find a way to adapt it. Don't have the knee so high, etc. Was there another one about knees, Nikki?
Those were the two.
Okay. All right. So mute yourself if you can. Thank you very much. If you got questions in the meantime, chat them in or write them down and we'll do other breaks for questions. Thank you to Chris for that. Let me go ahead and fire up the screen share here. Computer is running a little funny today, but knocking on wood, saying a prayer to the technology gods. Okay, hip drop. This is in your handout or in your course manual if you want. Hip drop is our theme. And that's what we want to see as a result of this sequence. That's the goal or the intention. We want that hip to be able to drop and the lumbars to release. And again, release we're saying is the ability to eccentrically lengthen under load when there is hip flexion. We're also looking to make sure that the QL releases. Now QL is a metaphor, it stands for quadratus lumborum, of course, but we're using that as an anatomical metaphor for the entire posterior abdominal wall. And I'll go through that with the anatomy. And also hip hinge differentiation, making sure that the leg and the hip can move independently. We started that project last time and we're going to continue it today. The indications, the time the client complains that would make me think of this sequence and make me use it would be hip hiking with the stork test. Now that you just did the stork test, basically, you were checking yourself with a knee up. You took your whole leg up, but it's essentially functionally equivalent. Take your knee or your leg up and ask, can you do that without hiking the hip? If I just ask someone to raise their knee and their hip goes up, that is hip hiking with the stork test. I would do this work. I would help them find a way to bring their knee up, hip flexion, without hiking that hip, without raising that side of the pelvis. Hip hinge restrictions, often those are functional, often it's just habits. And I'll show you some pictures of different habits and how we might work with them. But it's that idea that the hinge of the hip between the leg and the pelvis is really key. And we want it to have a full possibility of motion and then it can get restricted functionally or structurally. Sacroiliac joint or lumbar pain. These are often, there's some specific techniques in the sequence, but also the sequence as a whole is really indicated for those things. Sometimes it's just the right thing for that. And then sciatica and et cetera means like all these other kind of pelvic, low back, midsection conditions we've been talking about, as well as support, balance, athletic performance, et cetera. There's the picture in the manual, page C2, the stork test from the side view. We've adapted that over the years. So now in class, we tend to show that from the back more because it's easier to compare left and right. And that's what we do. We ask someone to raise their knee and we ask, does the hip raise when they raise their knee? And if it does, if the hip raises, if hip drop is diminished, then we work the lifting side QL and or supporting side abductors, like last sequence, essentially, or the sacrum. And I'll talk about that even more next time, how the sacrum might be part of this story. Okay, so I'll have them do both sides, lift each knee, look to see does one hip hike up more than the other. And by the way, if you want, while I'm talking about this, feel free to go right ahead and check yourself. if in doubt, move. In other words, you can actually just stand up and put your hands on your own hips and then flex your leg, bring one knee up and see if there's a difference in terms of hip hiking. And I don't know if you can see it, but it feels to me like my right one raises a little bit more than my left one. My left one is actually staying fairly low, doesn't hike. The right one hikes a little bit, and I can feel that as some recruitment around my midsection in order to flex that hip. So I would be really into getting this session. And I, as a practitioner, I would start with my right side, or at least focus on making sure that side learns how to drop with that hiking. Okay, Edward Muybridge, back to our studies in human and animal motion from the 1870s. He did a lot of stuff with stairs, and this is one of going upstairs. So it's a great chance to see hip hiking, but also leg pelvis differentiation. And if we can stack those up, gotta give it access to do that. Oh boy, grant access, good, here we go. If we stack that up in like a flip book and flip through those old images, we can see him walking up the steps and hip and hinging his hip. He's a great example of a hip hinger. He really does manage to keep pretty clear movement happening at his hip joint without recruiting much hip hiking, I could say. So his right hip is not particularly hiking up very high, even though he's lifting that knee with every step. On the other hand, this guy, to get up on the next step, really does recruit a lot of hip hiking. He's really lifting that right knee up by hiking his right hip. And that's the coloring there is showing the eccentric and concentric phases of those muscles. Don't get too hung up on that, but it's kind of interesting. I would say, to be probably more accurate, I think his everything is turning green about there. Everything in his low back, including his erectors, QL, et cetera, are firing when he brings the right knee up. And you can just get a qualitative difference too in those two styles of heading upstairs. Which one do you want to be? So that takes us right into the sequence there, where after some assessment with that Stork test, then we can start to look at the hip hinge per se. And there's a couple of variations shown there on the video where one is sideline, the other is with supine with my fingers. Anymore, I tend to do it with, you can also do a supine with your gentle forearm. It's a gentle functional technique. It's about education. It's about helping someone figure out how to move their knee without too much of the quads and the TFL and things like that firing and initiating the motion. And that's just in interest of helping differentiate that hinge. So right where you're sitting, if you want to try that, go ahead and put your own hands into your hip fold, the hip fold, and you can even rock forward like you're going to fold your hands in there. Another analogy here that's helpful is like origami, paper folding. You're going to fold right there around your hands. So that right there gives your body a sense of that hip joint in a way that might not be available otherwise. And then go ahead and pick one of your sides. I'm going to pick on my right here for a little bit. And I'm gonna keep my hands in that front of that hip joint and folding, find the hip joint. And then I'm gonna lift the knee gently. And as you lift the knee, most of us will pop that finger right out as the quads fire or the sartorius fires or the TFL fires, or those muscles, they're fire. They'll push your hand right out to bring the knee up. Now, take it from me, believe it or not, there is a way to move your knee without pushing your hands out. The simple way, it's cheating, but the simple cheat is to stand up on your toe. Yeah, instead of like use your quads to lift your knee, stand up on that toe, like so plantar flex the right foot if you're doing your right hip. And that'll give you the feeling of what it's like to actually raise the knee and get deeper in that fold, make the origami fold deeper. Okay, so that's the cheat. The interesting way, the educational way, is to not use muscles at all. Essentially, to use the natural buoyancy, you could say, of your kneecap to let your leg float up. So imagine that. Imagine that you might not need to push with the other foot, push with, say, the left foot in my case, to let the right knee be buoyant. But if the right knee can just float up a tiny bit, and we're talking micro movement here, that'll give you a sense of how that leg could actually initiate movement without recruiting the quads quite so much, or at least turning their role down as prime movers. So they're not the first thing that kick in and fire in that concentric contraction, like that sleeve, that outer layer of musculature that's so strong and helpful, but doesn't necessarily help us have refined, coordinated, subtle movement. So you're probably repeating this on your own. You're playing with your hands folded into your hip joint. You're pushing on the floor with the standing foot, and you're asking your body a puzzle. Can I let my knee float without pushing my hands out of the hip fold? You'll find it. When you do, you're actually, you've inhibited the quads and the hip flexors there. You've turned on your psoas, because often it's psoas, the deeper structure, that needs to find that motion. And you've distributed the coordination of the movement around to a larger set of structures, which is generally great anyway. Rather than just having that one group firing, you're getting everything to fire a little bit here. All right, so if you need any clarification, now's a good chance. Yep. Chat it in or raise your hand.
Yep. I got from Annette, are we just moving the knee up while leaving the foot on the floor? And someone requested that you demonstrate.
Uh-huh. So let's go back to the first one. Let's do it all together. Your left foot is on the floor. You're feeling your right side, your right hip fold. The cheat way is to stand on your right tippy toe. Yeah, that gives you a feeling of what it's like to fold in and demonstrate, huh? Yeah, I wish my camera had a bigger, so I'm here on the right side. Pretend that I'm sitting. If I stand on my tippy toe, that gives me a chance to feel like what this does without quads firing. So it's just I'm folding my fingers in more with lifting the leg. So the tippy toes are a cheat. Yeah, they allow me to get that folding feeling. But then what I want to do is find a way to fold those in rather than push them out without the toes. So can I actually let the knee float up as if by magic and fold these in rather than having the bunching of these tissues in the front of the hip push those structures out? It's a koan. It's an unanswerable question, but it's a worthy one to hurl our intentions against. So it's a movement puzzle that we play with and we help our clients play with. Can you move the knee without pushing me out? That might be the simple question I ask there. My client can picture me leaning into the front of my client's hip and asking that question as they do smaller and smaller movements until they find that. Okay, so Claire, do you want to do the hand raising and unmuting? Go ahead, let's check. I see some hands up.
We've got Kyra, sorry.
Computer said my mic is off.
We hear you.
Okay. Are you big with guiding visualization of like bringing the client's mind to where the psoas is in this to try to
I was going to say yes until you said psoas.
Oh,
because I'm big on visualization. I'm big on bringing their mind into the movement, but this is one that I haven't had really good results. I use your psoas because that means so many different things to people.
Yeah.
In fact, all this little sequence I just talked you through is a tricky way to get the psoas involved without getting too complicated about it. Mm-hmm. Can you lift your knee float up without pushing your hand out? Mm-hmm. When you do that, you're using your psoas.
Right.
The psoas is the hidden agenda here. Mm-hmm. Any other hands up?
No, nothing at the moment.
All right, great. So there's a picture. It only has a couple of the structures there, but you can imagine my hand there in the hip joint or my elbow, whatever the case may be, and cueing someone, a much smaller movement. This movement is way too big for a client, but just the initiation of the movement. Can you initiate the movement somewhere else besides pushing me out with those hip flexors? So you can, that shows how essentially you need to use the psoas if you're not going to use, say, quads. You need to use the psoas to move the knee. Another way to think of it is that let's go back to that one. We're inhibiting the structures we're pressing on, and we're asking the client to find something different that they don't usually use. So with the pressure and the technique, let's even go back to the picture of the technique if I can get there. Yep, there it is. So I'm inhibiting all the usual hip flexors and asking them to find the psoas instead. That's the other way to think about that, through my cueing and through slowing down and feeling and making the movement smaller. Okay, our other Muybridge model, walking down the stairs in this case, if we look at her in this with these eyes now, thinking hip drop, last time we looked at her in terms of hip shift, but if we look at her in terms of hip drop, this line will help you see it. She's pretty even left and right, but we could imagine how while she's stepping down, yeah, she's raising this knee, she's stepping down with this foot. This hip is actually, let's make sure I'm saying it right so that they can comprehend it. Okay, we're gonna turn around. So when she's, like the Stork test, when she's lifting this knee, this hip lifts a little bit. When she's lifting this knee lifts a little bit more. It's subtle. We'd almost have to mirror it to see, but we could say, yeah, she's actually hiking her right hip more than her left. It's subtle. I'll let you look at that yourself for a minute. So this is the knee that's lifting, the left one in this case. She is hiking a little bit. And in this one, the right one is lifting and she's hiking her right one even more. And that correlated with what we found last time too, in terms of the shift. We were gonna work on her right hip because of the shift as well. So, but that is the side that I would work to help have less hiking for her. Now, because both of them are hiking, I would actually work both sides. I would help her find a way not to need to do that. David is an amazing hip dropper. Yeah. And he's combining that drop on his left side here with some shift to the right. So he's got very fluid motion. It's no accident that Michelangelo depicted these motions as a symbol of grace and a kind of beauty, but he included both these factors in there as well. If we go back to the Gentlemen Prefer Blondes duo, Marilyn is, we talked about her being a hip shifter more than a shoulder shifter. She's also probably the epitome of a hip drop. She, as soon as she bends that knee, her hip just falls like nothing else, while Jane Russell is keeping her pelvis relatively level in this snapshot. So that's the factor we're looking for. Can someone keep it level or even drop it as opposed to hiking it? Now, too much drop, well, let's get to that in a second. When you drop, you're needing to allow eccentric loading, lengthening, in other words, eccentric contraction along the side that you're standing with, in this case, her right side. So you are allowing that to lengthen under control, under load. You're also doing a little bit of side bending in your lumbars to the opposite side. So this is just naming, this anatomical drawing is naming some of the structures that need to lengthen for that to happen. I wouldn't get too hung up on the specific structures. Those are good ones to keep in mind, but it's basically anything on the outer side of the hip or anything in the low back on this side are the ones that we need to lengthen in order to do that. And then in terms of contraction, this is talking about passive lengthening. In terms of contraction, it's the other way around. So here, this is the conventional model that if the hip drops, it could be because glute medius, minimus, even maximus is weak. So this could show a weakness rather than a tightness. And that too much of that drop is actually, is a sign sometimes of neurological conditions or excessive muscle inhibition. So if there's a whole lot of that drop going on, a conventional approach would be to strengthen the supporting side. And it's known as the Trendelenburg sign, which again can point to neurological issues or to just a weakness on one side or the other. We're looking at it the other way. If in this approach, we're saying what can't lengthen, not what necessarily what is weak, but what can't lengthen. So in this case, this person lifts their knee on their left and this side drops, bingo. We don't need to do this session, they got it. Yeah, in fact, we might look at shift. Are they able to shift in this case? But we're looking for a happy medium, the ability to drop, but not so much that there's no stability at all. And this concept here of the pelvis being able to stay relatively undisturbed in movement is one of the things we have in mind that in all sorts of movements, if you look at really high level athletes or people that just have a certain grace to them, the pelvis is moving less, the head is moving less, but everything is moving around those two centers of gravity. So as opposed to say, every time you move, the pelvis is tilting so much that the bowl of water spills, that would indicate that we can help things be a little more balanced, more options for movement, more refined proprioception around that structure. So if we go back to our Moravich model, he's doing a pretty good bowl of pretty good job of keeping his bowl from tipping. There's some, of course, naturally there's some pelvic tipping forward and back, but he's not sloshing from side to side a whole lot. There's another way to think of that. Okay, this technique here is a preparatory technique. It's earlier in the sequence. It's C3. It's the way we get ready for that. And essentially, it's a lumbar mobilization, or you could say a whole lateral line mobilization, but it's really what I'm doing. I'm using the leg as a handle to rock the pelvis, and then really need a video to see that. But let me see if I can stop the screen share, perhaps. Yeah, stop the screen share and show you on my little step, and feel free to join me. But if I step up on that little step with one foot, yeah, and I have a tilted step, so it's extra challenging, but then I can play with actually dropping that hip down off of that step. So I'm stepping with one side and dropping the other. That's what I'm doing in that technique. Essentially, I'm using the leg to passively drop the hip to the side bend the lumbar spine, or shortening the space and lengthening the space on the table. Brian, you got a quick question? I got you unmuted. Please go ahead.
Yes. I noticed in the two images of the bodybuilder guy and then the anatomical one, that the guy is more in upright position, and then the one from your anatomical one, he's in more forward flexion. So it just seems like the more forward flexion you're in going upstairs, especially if you're carrying bags, that you're automatically going to be using QL and the erectors to hike up because of the load that you have in your hand going up the stairs.
Could be. Although we want the capability not to have to do that. We want someone to be able to flex their hip and climb stairs without needing to hike the hip in flexion or in neutral, either way. But at therapeutically, at least from my point of view, a functional, like say a movement trainer might do something different. But from my point of view, I'm going to check it in all sorts of different positions and see where, like we did with Chris, see where the hiking gets difficult and work with it there. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Okay, back to our screen share. And here we go. So that's, essentially we're working with is the lumbar space for a lot of these techniques. The lumbar space is spanned by soft tissue, as well as, of course, the lumbar spine. The soft tissues relate in a kind of lattice-like or spiraling-like arrangement around the entire body. So don't get too myopic, even though a lot of today is about that space. Of course, that space is representing what's going on through the whole system, up and down. But let's give ourselves permission for a little bit of myopia here for a second, because this one, the iliac crest technique on page C5, I'm thinking right precisely on the attachments of that posterior abdominal wall onto the iliac crest. The iliac crest is an amazing stopover zone for structures from above and below. Here's my friend Helmut welding up that sculpture that I'm going to show you some more pictures of. And here he is welding on the iliac crest of his sculpture he's making. And like the human body, his sculpture has a lot of attachments on that crest from both above and below. Here's his sculpture when he was done. So he's essentially starting to weld up that crest. And he used, in his sculpture, he used rebar, iron reinforcing bar, to construct the erector bundles and the transversus and the obliques as they span through that lumbar space. And all those things attach to the iliac crest. So what do we like about attachments? We like the Golgi potential those give. So that technique, the iliac crest technique, I'm essentially leaning on those crests in a nice way, maybe with a forearm, maybe with a knuckle, thinking about changing the resting tone of all those structures by signaling the Golgi tendon organs to inhibit the muscular tonus of those muscles that attach there. So this might be static. Yeah. I might warm things up with a pretty slow, gentle glide, think superficial layers, but pretty soon I'm going to get down, at least in this version of the technique, down to that bony level where we're right on those tendinous attachments of all of those posterior back structures onto the iliac crest. Now this model is turned around. So here's the hip, here's the crest with the head up at the other way, the lower picture here. And so what I'm doing in that technique is I'm leaning on the attachments of all of those structures. And the green stuff here is an interesting structure in the body. That's the thoracolumbar fascia, or sometimes called the lumbar dorsal fascia. But it's a complicated, multi-pocketed structure that surrounds the erectors, surrounds the obliques, surrounds the TA, the quadratus, et cetera, and even has extensions that go around the psoas. It's the green in this cross section here, showing how all of those muscles, which is what we usually learn in anatomy, are surrounded by this one structure, the thoracolumbar fascia, that attaches to the iliac crest. The fascia blends with those tendinous attachments, and it extends all the way up as far as the erectors go, all the way up into the neck. So we often learn muscles in isolation in anatomy. Here's QL, here's an illustration of what it does. If you contract it, it'll side bend you. Now, if you can imagine that structure as a metaphor for what's happening in that space, you can see how if he didn't let himself side bend, it could hike the hip up. That structure could hike the hip up as well on that side. So C6 is about hip hiking. But I'm thinking before we get into the technical of this layering, because there's a few things that are really important in there, I'm thinking it might be a moment for another little movement break on around hip hiking. So I'm going to stop my screen share. And I'm going to bring in our guest movement person, Carmen. Carmen, are you ready for us? You can unmute yourself if you are. I think you probably want people standing up for this. Is that right, Carmen?
Yes. I need everybody standing up. And I need to take my background so people can see me.
I need to get myself off the, yeah, okay. Now I think, Claire, if you're able to spotlight, or Laureen, maybe, if you're able to spotlight Carmen, that'd be great. I don't have that capability here. Hey, nice.
I think, okay, I think you can see me. Okay, Teal asked me to do a little exercise of hip dropping, and I got why he asked me to do that. So just by watching him dancing now and then, I realized that he needs like baby steps to it. And that's why we are going to be having right now, like literally baby steps, because this song that we're going to play is a children's game that when you guys were doing the Itsy Bitsy Spider, we in the Caribbean here were dancing and singing this song. So if you want, you can sing along with me, all right? So, Teal, hit it.
We are ready. Here we go.
Put your hands here so you can really feel your hips.
Okay, Carmen, talk to me. What do you need there? Ah, music. Sorry, it's playing here. Okay, let me try again. I was like rocking out to the music here, but I got to get it tuned in so you guys can hear it. I wonder why you're all standing still. Okay, here we go. One more try. Here we go. Tell me. Give me a thumbs up if something happens.
Morena, wey, ¿a dónde va ese ritmo caramba del merecumbe? Un pasito adelante y otro para atrás, y dando la vuelta, ¿quién se quedará? Chequi morena, wey, ¿a dónde va ese ritmo caramba del merecumbe? Un pasito adelante y otro para atrás, y dando la vuelta. Y dando la vuelta, ¿quién se quedará? Chequi Morena, Chequi.
Is this tempo to... Okay, now. Are you ready for the advanced technique now? For the advanced class? Okay.
I'm ready.
So this, a disclaimer. The insurance here doesn't have liability for hip replacement or anything. So take it easy, guys.
I think this prevents that danger. This prevents hip replacements.
The second is that it really helps when the action really happens to put the mouth like this. There is some anatomical relationship between the orbis, whatever, and the pelvic. I don't know, but Till we'll figure it out later. Okay.
Okay, here we go.
El juez le digo al cura.
Cura.
Cura le digo al juez.
¿Qué juez?
¿A dónde va ese ritmo, caramba? Chequi morena, chequi. Chequi morena, juez. ¿A dónde va ese ritmo, caramba? Y el merecumbe. Un pasito adelante y otro para atrás. Y dando la vuelta, y dando la vuelta. Y él se quedará.
Baila,
Chequi Morena,
Marilo baila,
Chequi Morena,
Danilo baila,
Chequi Morena,
Galo baila,
Chequi Morena,
Yamilis baila,
Chequi Morena,
Malo baila.
All right, thank you everybody. Don't stop.
You.
If you don't want to stop, don't stop.
Thank you,
Teal. Okay. Yeah, don't stop, like I said, but let's see. Let's go back to some more. So hip drop, yeah, that's what gets inhibited, you know, and that's what we're restoring. I don't know what kind of music you use in your practice, but there's some options. Carmen will share her playlist, I think, as well, if you want. Chequi Morena. Okay, we're about to go into iliolumbar ligaments, C6. Give me a thumbs up if you see my screen, because there's lots of controlling going on here. Yay, good. Iliolumbar ligaments, quadratus lumborum technique is basically about that space, and there's several layers there. We go through them in detail also in our spine class. In the pelvis class, we're looking at the particular relationship of the pelvis to the spine. So that space includes quadratus lumborum, yeah, the spanning that space, but there's lots of other great stuff in there. This is going to show us, again, quadratus lumborum, the spanning between the rib and the top of the hip, how it actually attaches, or is part of actually these ligaments, the iliolumbar ligaments. They're the lower end of it, as well as that crest. And if we change our angle so that we can see it from different points of view, we really get that it's the back wall of the abdomen. And the fascia around it, that thoracolumbar fascia, which also goes around the big erectors behind it, are part of the support or the backstop behind this bowl or the basket of the pelvis. So looking down now into the zone that we were thinking about last time, here we can see the obturator fascia and the pelvic floor attachments. Here we have piriformis, obturator, etc. And then these iliolumbar ligaments are helping lace the sacrum into the pelvis with the liacus shown, but psoas taken out of this picture. Now, in a real body, in a human body, it's a lot less neat and clean. It's just a whole bunch of fibers there, and it's so dense that it's often hard to tell where L5, say, starts and the ilium stops. This is all basically knit in with so many dense ligaments that it's not quite so pretty as these pictures. But in that technique, I'm thinking about that zone. So now we're in front of the thoracolumbar fascia. We're behind the psoas, but we're into that zone where those ligaments are as some of the key attaching structures between pelvis and spine. So here I've walked around to the side of the table in the technique. I've worked with some preparation to help that posterior wall of the abdomen be receptive, be pliable enough, be waited for viscoelastic change, waited for some relaxation, so that we can gently sink down into the iliolumbar region in front of the erectors, anterior to the erectors, inside the pelvic bowl a little bit, but behind all the viscera. I'm not poking anything visceral with those thumbs, for example. So that's where I eventually get to. It's pretty deep. It takes some time. It takes taking care of your own thumbs, but it's one of those magic spots where people will really get how their back pain could be related to what's happening right here. Sometimes it'll trigger someone's back pain and relieve it as you stay there and have them gently move. Movements, I think, might be listed on that page, but they include some gentle hip flexion or some gentle pelvic rocking or just breathing. Just breathing is really good there too. So this close-up here shows a great view of the thoracolumbar fascia in green, and then those sacral ligaments in purple. Okay, questions at all? Chat them in or raise your hand. What about the multifidi? Someone says, absolutely, they're behind all this. We're way behind there. We haven't gotten to those yet. So we're on the anterior side of the spine, and it's and with the level of the crest. So we're way far forward from the multifidi. We're getting there. Intercostal involvement. In fact, we get into that pretty specifically in the spine workshop, but we're below intercostals at this point. Of course, you could go up from the QL and all this stuff and continue up into diaphragm and into intercostals. But we're thinking the space between ribs and spine. So I'm not thinking that specifically yet. Okay, so now if we go, I'm going to take you back a little bit here. Yeah, I think that's the next one in your book. Well, let's go ahead and review this one. So here I'm reaching in front of the erectors, reaching inside the pelvic bowl. I'll be cueing a little bit of knee movement, some breathing. Shouldn't be uncomfortable. You can see that it's the banner's a little bit in the way, but you can see I have her on her towel to help keep the spine in a neutral position, because if someone has a narrow waist, just the position means that their pelvis and rib cage could fall together and make it hard to get into that space comfortably. So keeping the spine neutral with some bolstering and then having someone move their knee where I'm looking for the lumbar ligaments, for example, and that quadratus as the metaphor for the entire posterior wall of the abdomen. That's the essence of that technique there. This is showing how massive the erectors are. So I'm in front of all those. I haven't even mentioned them much because not that we shouldn't, but we basically go into them in so much detail in our other classes that they become less of the focus here. But some of the questions that got asked about multifidi in this zone, or iliocostalis, for example, or rib muscle, are crossing the space too. So they could be part of you helping with hip hike as well. If you just use a broader tool, instead of like the thumbs getting down in deep, which you've done after you've warmed things up, in that process of preparation, you can use a broader tool like a gentle soft fist or a super careful forearm. in this whole posterior region here, that's going to help someone be aware of how they might be hiking their hip. And again, you're working to help them find alternatives to that. C7, gluteus maximus. Gluteus maximus technique there. It's pretty cool. It's kind of tricky to describe and take a picture of. What I'm doing is I'm working on the downside now, the lower side of the client. Yeah, so far we've been working on the upper side. So now I haven't moved them, but now I'm working on the contralateral left side attachments of gluteus maximus. We did some of this in pushbroom A. We got some of this region in pushbroom A, some more of it in the sacrotuberous ligament technique. But this is just another approach where now I have gravity on my side and I can use a forearm here to essentially lean into these tendinous attachments on the sacrum, maybe a bit on the ilium, but for sure on sacrotuberous ligament. This is the sensations there are really interesting. They really are tendinous as opposed to muscular when you find them. And what we love about tendons, we love their sensitivity because they talk to the essential resting tone of that muscle. So we don't have to, they save us work. We don't have to go through there and teach the whole muscle how to relax. By just leaning on the tendon, we're talking to the brain, rather the spinal cord directly so that it's controlling the resting tone of that muscle, a shortcut to affect the whole structure's resting tone, which is essentially what we're trying to do when we relax things anyway. Another view, now the gluteus maximus has been taken off. This is the same view we saw before, but now turned sideways. But this is the region that I'm working on with my forearm or elbow or even a soft fist. Now this, I like this illustration, it's fun. It's, they made the sacrotuberous ligament into a muscle in this one. So that's kind of cool. It's not a muscle on people that I mean, I don't think it is. Maybe there's some people that have it as a muscle, but I'm not trying to relax the sacrotuberous ligament. It's like I would these other structures. I'm thinking of it, it's attachment point for the gluteus maximus. The gluteus maximus attaches onto that ligament. So those tendinous insertions onto the ligament are probably Golgi targets as well. Okay, Aubrey's saying, what side of the gluteus maximus medial attachments are you working on? Opposite side of the hiked hip. Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, opposite side of the hiked hip. It's part of that control thing. Yeah. So like if me on me, somehow PowerPoint has decided to take control of the show here. I'm back in control. Like on me, I was hiking my right hip a little more. I did all that work with my client on the right side to help get a sense of length here, including work deep down into the iliolumbar ligament. The contralateral supporting side would be, just logically, would be this left side attachments there. Now that's my working hypothesis. The test comes from actually having someone get up and walk a little bit and feeling what's different. Because sometimes you'd get unpredictable results, maybe every time. And so what really counts is what helps someone find the release there. But yeah, there's good argument that in order to let this side lengthen when the knee is flexed, this side needs to be stable and engaged without too much locking. So that's what we're doing with that medial attachments technique. Let me check some more questions out here. This is cool. I got it figured out so I can see them at the same time. Wouldn't the hip lift side need work too? Sure. Yeah, work them both. Amanda's question. Yeah, work it all. If in doubt, work it all and see what helps. So yeah, these theories about which side to work are, again, working hypotheses that we need to test. I'm trying to understand Brian's question here. Because of all the ligaments in the pelvis, could people's hip pelvis issues be more ligamentous than muscular? Yeah, right, totally. Or fascial, yeah, or neurological. Heck, why not? It's all these things here. And again, a lot of people are trained in muscular anatomy. But I, and those of you who went through, say, the structural integration tradition didn't do that so much. We got trained in like a fascial tradition, so there was less emphasis on the muscles per se. The muscles were seen as the filler in these cool envelopes we're learning about. But it's all of it. It really is all of it as well. Okay, so the rib cage stretch, we're starting in their home stretch there now, so to speak, the integration phase of the work, where it's just going back and rechecking the passive ability, that space to open up. I might go back to the leg as a handle technique. That's another way to do it, doing a similar thing, just checking the adaptability and extensibility of that lumbar space. The nuchal window technique. Now we got some, now we've really moved into the integration phase. So maybe I've done the work I want to do on both sides. I get people up and I have them walk. And recheck with the Stork test again. A lot of times things are different just automatically from what happens on the table. But if not, the rechecking is a chance to raise awareness even more about what happens when they support with one leg. And you could say you've really made the system more available with the work. Or if there were, say, structural limitations, you've started to address those and help things be a little bit more adaptable and pliable there so that the functional learning can take place. So it's a chance to slow it down after you've done the work and have someone stand again and really in slow motion play with the kind of thing Chris was doing, or just bringing the knee up and seeing what's it like to leave the hips level now, or even to let that side drop as you bring the knee up. A lot of times it'll be more available after the work, and that's a kind of learning that the brain is available for after you've done that deep, focused, hands-on work that you can't get to in some other ways as well. So I've done all that. I've worked on the work I want to do on both sides. I've had them stand up. We've done some coaching or some integrating of them feeling what we're after in that session. And then we lay back down, and I'm going to check their neck as a way, again, as a bookmark in our sequence to say, do something to bring the focus out into the rest of the body. And traditionally in the, say, especially in the osteopathic tradition, we, at the end of the session, we check the neck and we check the sacrum, the two ends of the spine, head and tail. So here I am with this technique, I'm feeling up between the bundles of the erectors and checking their ability to widen in the suboccipital zone. So I'm pulling them away from the nuchal ligament. It's not necessarily trying to get in there and say, scrape the nuchal ligament itself, as much as it is helping those structures move away from that midline. So there's nuchal ligament in one of Primal Pictures versions, and my hands are either side of that, sinking in, helping things move away from that, almost like pulling the curtains open in the window so that the brainstem can get a little bit of a draft, get a little bit of air back there and wake things up or help clear the thoughts. Before we get to the homework, let me check back in. You can chat in your question. It's a great time to raise your hand too. Let's check for questions here. Oh, wow. Okay. That's cool. Okay. Here's one. Somebody loves the nuchal window technique. Yeah. It's one to love, one to do on yourself. There's some good self versions. There's Brian says, should we check the Q angle of knee to hip? Big discussion. No, I don't, not my approach necessarily. I used to, but I'm not looking at the alignment, say, of the knee per se, in that conventional way of, say, Q angle, as much as I am looking at the leg's ability to support the body. And some of that goes to the debate about the significance of Q angle, Q angle being the alignment of the knee. Turns out that unless you're a really high-level athlete or bench-pressing a whole lot of weight, that there isn't a really strong correlation between Q angle and performance nor injuries. So it's probably a low, a small lever to try to move a big thing. I'm much more interested in how people can support themselves over their leg. And that's not to say that I'm not paying attention to what the leg is doing. I am looking at the whole leg, but not down to that refined little level of what is the exact angle between the two bones. It's a bit more global view of, can I shift my pelvis over that standing leg? And then can I have some sense of adaptability and options in its drop and hiking over that standing leg as well.
There's a question from David.
David. Yeah, I got it, Claire. I think I can do this. David, I think I have you unmuted. Go ahead.
You do. Good morning. You didn't cover this. You mentioned the psoas as something we're getting to globally. I've come across about six people who have a distinct audible clicking sound, inflection and extension of one side of their hip. Do you attribute that, assuming no other injuries, is that generally a psoas minor issue? Is that a tendinous bundle? What is your experience? Have I given you enough information to answer the question?
Yeah, no, I love clicks. And Whitney Lowe and I are actually, one of our slated topics for the podcast we do is on clicks and cracks and what could be the mechanisms and what they might mean and how their therapeutic implications, all those kinds of things. Sure. So that click that you get when someone flexes their hip, it could be any number of things. It could be the actual, you know, the ligaments right around the joint capsule itself pumping over something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be a sliding of, like you say, that psoas tendon over something as well. There's okay. probably a dozen things it could be. The short answer is, though, I'm not too worried about it if it's not painful. A click doesn't mean problem. Necessarily.
Not necessarily, of course. Just I've been asked that question so many times. I'm looking forward to the podcast. I'll take the rest of the answer there.
Great. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to underline that a little more just to say that, you know, a click doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem. It gets our attention. It gets our client's attention. They think, what's wrong in there? Something's clicking. And certainly if it clicks and it hurts, that's an issue. Yeah. But the clicking by itself just means something's bumping. We don't even know what. A lot of times it's soft tissue. Sometimes it can be a cavitation. You can have a joint that's actually popping. Usually that only happens once and then needs a while before it does it again. So that's one way to start to kind of troubleshoot or pick apart what it might be. If it's repeatable, like every time they flex their hip, it's probably just a ligament bumping over a bony structure or another soft tissue structure. It's like strumming a bass. You know, it's just like a little strumming going on, which is not necessarily a problem. Things slide around all the time. And just because they slide and then bump doesn't mean they're necessarily messed up or even going to be. Now, you know, somebody who's painful and clicking, like a jaw that crunches and hurts, that's something that I pay attention to. That's, you know, the crunching there is a sign that there's not only some sensitivity, the hurting, but there may be some roughening of the surface or possible joint dynamics that are creating that noise. But even then, I'm not saying that all jaw crunches are bad and all hip crunches are good. I'm just saying just the noise itself isn't a reliable indicator of something that we need to fix, let's put it that way, other than to help the client be less disturbed by that noise. Now, that's fun. It's a fun project to go in there and see if we can quiet it down. And a lot of times you can. A lot of times you can find things that if you hang out on them and have them move, essentially you can turn down the tension on the base, yeah? Or you can cause enough sliding of structures around there so it doesn't quite slip over the same spot. But that's, you know, it's a fun project. More than a therapeutic intervention, I'd say. Larry, go ahead. You got something you want to say?
Yeah, you had a question from Audrey Wong. Can you go over again how the medial glute max on the contralateral side may be less differentiated as possible result of the hip hike?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily less differentiated. It's not just the medial, but it's probably the whole gluteal complex. That side needs to stabilize in order to drop the hip. Let me see if I can show that. So differentiated is like a tissue description. I'm talking about maybe more of a functional description. So let me see. If I lift this hip, yeah, and hike, it's because this gluteus is helping do that, yeah, on the standing side. So that technique says, if you're hiking this hip, let's work this guy's attachments on the downside. We get a hold of that and we help them have a broader tonal range. We help them relax more and have a bigger range of possibility in their movement because they're the ones that are, you know, helping grab in that stabilization process. Did that help, Aubrey? I'm going to take that as a yes. Great. What else? I'm probably missing some. Is your podcast available on a PlayNAC or only live? Yeah, podcast is available at thethinkingpractitioner.com. It's also on our site under the blog menu item, or actually I think it's a podcast menu item on our website, or anywhere you get your podcast, just look for my name or Whitney's name or The Thinking Practitioner. And a podcast you can listen to anytime. It's a recorded thing that you can go back to and listen to. Yeah, someone else is saying iTunes. Yeah, all those things. All those guys have it. Okay. Any other questions? Q&A time. Fantastic. Faculty. Yeah, faculty, go ahead and... you can prepare your tips, your top tips for this session too. Brian, you want to go ahead? It looks like you're unmuted. Go ahead, Brian.
It's David.
Okay, David, hang on a second there. Let's get Brian's question. I'm going to mute you, David. Brian, are you having a question you want to ask? If so, I have.
Yeah, what about the foot? We land with the foot, the three arches of the foot. To me, that's the foundation. If as a runner, if there are any issues in there, it's just going to go right into the hip. To me, that's one of the most important things, even maybe even before the hip, is to make sure that foundational step is sound in all
aspects.
You're
so right. You are so right. We should have taught the hip the foot class first. What was I thinking? It's true. You know, that really does depend on the foot. But then there's that neck. Geez, if the neck isn't adaptable, then the hip can't move either. Shoot. What are we going to do?
Teach it all.
That's it.
More.
That's what we'll do. Yes. Absolutely. Everything the hip is doing is dependent on what's below it and above it to some extent. So, yeah, you're right. We got to keep remembering that big picture thing. Thank you. Okay, David, did you have a question? You want to go ahead and unmute yourself?
Yeah, TL. It was really in the middle when you saw the person walking up or down the step. And it was just like Brian just said, I think it's from the heel all the way to the knee, and that affects the way the leg is going to rotate in the hip joint. So, you know, a little working in that lower section, maybe doesn't make it so obvious to do it, to do such dramatic work at the hip area. So we were both on the same thought pattern, I think.
Many paths to the one, as they say. Many entry points, and a lot of it is the narrative that makes the most sense to me as a practitioner and the thing that feels right to the client. So yeah, a lot of people will get these amazing effects on the hip by working somewhere completely different. And there's some complicated and complex rationales or narratives that explain that, including myofascial chains, neurological effects, systemic effects, harmonic effects, something too, probably all of those. But the truth is that you can get some of these results through any number of routes. And it gets into those chicken and egg questions too, doesn't it? You know, should we always start at the heel, or should we always start at the atlas, as some practitioners say? And you've probably heard me say this, but in those kind of chicken and egg debates, my rule of thumb is it's generally the chicken. So start there, and then that really helps it clear things up. Larry, you had a question from somebody?
Yes, it's, did you want to talk about the fixed side bend sacrum effect on the hip drop?
Yeah, I do want to talk about that. That's next lecture.
Perfect.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. That's a cool one. That's coming up. All right, faculty, your tips, your things to keep in mind. Rather than me calling you just go ahead, faculty, and unmute yourself if you got a tip about the sequence or anything else you want to share. Okay, maybe I will call on you. Larry and Bethany. Oh, go ahead. Who is that?
It was Nikki.
Nikki, okay.
I just find that having a pelvis in my office is helpful, just letting people know where we're going. In all these sequences around the pelvis.
Besides your own.
Yes, besides my own. Can just establish that, you know, calm the nervous system a little bit, let them know where we're headed, you know, always be in communication, watching facial expressions, those types of things.
Super important. Thank you, Nikki. Larry, Bethany, have any tips you want to leave us with?
This is Larry. Yeah, I definitely find the iliac crest and the iliolumbar ligaments a real prime territory for all of this. But it's also, if they really need the work, it's going to be tough in there, and you definitely have to take it in layers or only go as much as the client can accommodate as far as that. Any movements you do might help out, or have the client do might help out with accessing some deeper layers. So definitely have the client work into this area, because it will be tender. The more they can work, the easier the work might be.
Bethany here, also about the iliolumbar ligaments technique. I saw a lot of people on the chat commenting on how helpful it was to remember to put some kind of support, a towel or a small pillow for some people at the waist. Not only is that really helpful, but some clients will actually find that they start using it when they sleep and having less back pain. So if you already have like a real difference, a small waist to hip ratio, it might be something to offer them.
Nice. Bruce, Chris, Lorene.
I got one. This is Lorene. I'm going to make a pitch for remembering to be really creative and curious. So a couple of these techniques, I'm thinking particularly of the leg as handle and pelvis rib cage stretch, which it's easy to kind of brush over quickly, but they're really worth a lot of exploration. And you can learn a lot from your client, really taking the time to explore different vectors, different ways of movement, really using your own body to do a bit of a dance with them. Worthy of spending some time there. That's my tip.
Thank you. So important. Yeah, that's great. Go ahead, Bruce.
This is Bruce. I'm agreeing with everyone, but also keep in mind, in this Stork test, we're looking for the hip to be able to drop, but also conversely, we're looking for the stabilizing leg to be able to support in an eccentric kind of motion. So look at both sides as well, because they're working together as a unit.
Nice. Excellent. Chris?
Yeah.
Can you share?
Techniques aside, the piece that I find so fascinating is at the end of a session, really give your client a chance to check in and describe what they're noticing, ask them what they feel that's different. And as much as we may have been focusing on the hip, if that was the focus of a session, I love to find out what else they notice. Do they stand differently in their feet? Does their head sit on their shoulders in a new way? They feel taller. It's always surprising to discover how somebody's body is connected, and sometimes in ways that, you know, I wasn't thinking of when I was working. So your clients can be very informing in our own process of learning as practitioners. But I love for them to walk out and go, wow, I had no idea that my hip released, I could stand in a different way. So that's a lovely question to ask your clients. Really check in with their response.
It's really important. I'm so glad that we had a chance to hear from you guys. Those are crucial points. A couple more questions in the chat. Where do you get a pelvis? Wherever you buy your bones and anatomical supplies, just stop by. They're going to have pelvises. I'm kidding you a little bit. You know, Amazon has become, for better or worse, our town square for commerce. And there are certainly other options. Google Shopping, there's another option. You know, Carolina Medical Supply is the one we used to use way back in the day. Now, Carolina Medical Supply sells most of their stuff through Amazon. So, you know, check it out. Just go to Amazon and type in pelvic model or something like that, and you see all sorts of choices. Or use your search engine and plug it in. You can get lots of smaller suppliers that will sell to you directly, which is great for them, by the way. Speaking as a small supplier, we sell a lot of our DVDs and books through Amazon. It's always helpful when people buy right from us, and we try to keep our prices even better than Amazon as well. All right, so I'm going to go back to the last couple slides and take us home. I need to turn the screen share back on for it to do that so that you can see it. Home study this week. It's in your printed out packet or it's on your course navigator. So you're going to watch the sequence that we've been introducing you to, or you know, play with those ideas from the book. There's some chapters there in volume 1 and volume 2 that relate to what we've been speaking about today. And then there's a whole chapter in the dynamic body, which Eric Dalton put together that I wrote for that collection, that also reviews a lot of these things from these last two sequences. It's all those things we did. Go ahead and activate the in-class discount code on. If you don't know them already, you can save the money on there. They are optional. Really, the goal here has been to do a standalone presentation that'll inspire you enough to go start to try some things out, either in your own movement, work with yourself, or when you get back to work with your clients. So we're going to continue that recommendation of actually take this into your own body through turning one of these things you've seen into a movement, self-exercise, or a mobilization for yourself. Be ready to share that with your study group. And then note down questions as you go through these things to either apply it, to review it, or to study it that you can bring to your small groups. This has been a fun experiment. We've had really high participation in the small groups. We weren't sure how many people would take advantage of that, but uptake has been really high and great conversations as well. It spurred some fun background conversations between us and the faculty too, to think through the questions you're bringing, rich and detailed questions that are helping us articulate and clarify what we're bringing to you to offer. Now, if you want to give feedback anytime, just send an email, you know, or whatever, but you can also go use the form if you want to, that's on the course navigator or in the emails you get. If you want to submit private feedback or systematic feedback, there's a form available to you in every one of those emails on every page of that homework thing where you can just fill out feedback about what's working for you or any suggestions you have for us. Appreciate all of those. For sure. There's the book chapter, and that's it, folks. Did we cover everything, Nikki? Did we cover all the last bits we should cover?
Yes, it looks like it. Just a lot of gratitude going on right now.
Likewise for me. Likewise for me. So yeah, have fun with that home study. Have a look at that. You know, go play with it in your own body. Play with it with anybody that you're able to work with. And we'll see you in a small group, or we'll see you here again next week, same time.
Also, Till.
Hey, Till.
Zoga, Monday.
Zoga.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Plug for Zoga. If you're not in the Zoga, we're still taking people. We're still getting people signing up. It's Wojtek Kakowski, physiotherapist and manual therapist, teaching movement methods and techniques for our own bodies. He's relating it in a really nice way to these sequences, and it gives inspiration for things you might go do with your clients, but the focus is mostly on our own bodies. Can't recommend it enough, and a sliding scale. So check that out if you haven't already. A lot of you I know have already jumped in, but it's a great opportunity. Thank you. Anything else, faculty? Going once, going twice. Super. Thank you all. See you later. See you next time.